Part 1 of 6 from set number 3001, Alchemy Past and Present, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Royal Art of Transformation, an Introduction to Alchemy.
First of all, what does the very word, the very term alchemy mean? It comes from the Arabic. Al is, you know, the article like THE in English, just like alcohol, which is also an Arabic name. Interestingly enough, well, Muslims are not supposed to drink it. We are still using their term for it. And alchemy, as far as we are able to determine, the term probably arose in Arabic as the result of the Arab conquest of Egypt and the discovery in Egypt on the part of the Arabs of alchemical activities. And so they used the ancient name of Egypt, which is Chem, that means black, the dark land, the black land, owing to the black mud of the Nile. And Al-Chem really means the Egyptian thing. So the Egyptian art, the Egyptian science, as it came to be called. However, as you will see, alchemy is a fairly universal preoccupation, although its symbol system varies from culture to culture. We have Western alchemy, which is the one that we will be principally concerned with, which is really Middle Eastern alchemy, most likely developed originally in Egypt. And then, however, wherever we go in the world, we find some alchemy. There's certainly alchemy in India, a lot of wonderful alchemical stories about India. And there is a special kind of alchemy in China, the Taoist alchemy, which I will very briefly describe in the latter part of this evening's discussion. So some form of alchemy we find almost everywhere in the world. Now, trying to define alchemy a little bit further, what is it? It is a symbolic system of transformation. Symbolic systems of one kind or the other exist, of course, and you are aware of many of them. The ways in which ancient peoples have approached the nature of life and the meaning of life and of human life has been primarily by way of symbols. It is only our own age, the modern and now perhaps postmodern age, that has made an attempt, not altogether successful, I fear, in approaching life pretty much without symbols. A non-symbolic approach to life is rather difficult to establish or to practice. But the ancient ones always were symbolic. So we have, for instance, astrology. Almost everybody knows about astrology, which uses the stars and the planets as the constituent elements of its symbol system. Or look at Kundalini Yoga, to jump to something else, which uses the physical body and certain centers, which Carl Jung has called psychic localizations on the body, as its symbolic system of transformation. Look at the Kabbalah, the ancient Jewish system. There you have a diagram of the tree of life, and it's primarily its attribution there on the channels of the tree of life by way of the Hebrew letters as a symbol system. So we have a good many of these symbolic systems, and at least in certain aspects, they all really address themselves to the same thing, which is the possibility of a substantial change, a radical transformation of the psycho-spiritual nature of the human being, so that when we undergo such a transformation, we may end up with a greatly expanded kind of consciousness. That's what most, if not all, of the symbol systems of the world are about, at least in large part. There may be other elements added to this objective in addition to that. So we might say then that the alchemical symbol system also addresses itself to this objective, but it uses a set of symbols that are rather different from the others that we just mentioned. Astrology uses the starry heavens, so in order to contemplate those symbols, you really need to look very far. The air has to be probably a little bit less hazy than it happens to generally be over Los Angeles to see the stars properly. In fact, you almost might say that alchemy is the very opposite pole from the starry symbolism of astrology, because alchemy uses the elements and the chemicals of Earth as its symbol system. And now, of course, the question immediately arises, which we will play around with as time goes on, and which we'll particularly explore on the next occasion in connection with Jung's view of alchemy, as to how much of alchemy is psychological. Now, I would suggest that while alchemical symbols do not directly translate into psychological conditions, we might perhaps say that certain psychological conditions within the human and certain chemical or alchemical processes both contain a common denominator of meaning, that they are joined by a certain kind of common meaning. Now, this is not easy to comprehend, but, you know, meaning is more than a kind of this equals that kind of meaning, this means that. Meaning is a much more mysterious kind of thing. And when outwardly, seemingly unrelated processes and circumstances are joined by a common meaning, that means then that one can sort of transgress from one kind of reality into another, that there is a transgressivity between the two. I don't want to go into this at great length at the present moment because it's very abstract without, let's say, the Jungian psychological aspect. So I think we need to comprehend at the very outset that the symbol system of alchemical transformation always had a profound connection with, was always joined in a kind of mysterious way by way of meaning to the interior nature of the human, and that is how it can be really best understood and best explained. This kind of a problem that I alluded to now would not have been a problem to most of the ancient peoples and most of the practitioners of alchemy throughout history, for the simple reason that they possessed a worldview rather different from the one that we possess in this age. In their worldview, all things and all developments and processes were not only interconnected with each other, but they also replicated each other's patterns at various levels or planes of reality. And that means that if you properly affinitized yourself to one of these symbol systems, you automatically acquired an understanding of some of the others, and more importantly, of the interior system of development within yourself to which these related. And it's only in our age where we have owing to the way that our intellectual development proceeded, especially in the Western world, we have chopped up all the various disciplines, all the various fields of knowledge into rather separate compartments. And we have lost sight of the subtle underlying connections between these. I still think I'm not making all that much sense. But as we go on, particularly when we look into the psychological and also in the medical implications of alchemy, then it will become more apparent how the pattern of alchemical transformation and of the relationship of the various alchemical elements appears on the one hand in the human psyche and in its own transformative processes, and also in the conditions and the processes of the human body. So that what we are really dealing with here is a pattern, a symbolic way of understanding realities. And once one has become affinitized to that pattern, then one begins to see its applications in various fields. Now, the key concept, the paramount key concept of alchemy is one single thing, and that is transformation. Now, transformation has become somewhat of a buzzword in recent years in certain circles, and whenever something becomes very popular and becomes a kind of a buzzword, it begins to lose its true and specific meaning. That is the way things are. The more people embrace a particular concept, the more likely it is that the concept is going to become muddled and after a while won't mean anything. And that is to a great extent what has happened to the word of transformation nowadays. And whenever we sort of like something and it excites us a little bit, we exclaim, "Oh, that is so transformative," you know. But that's not what it necessarily is. It just tickles us somewhere, somehow. Now, the principle of transformation is declared by the alchemists to be the great, really the great essence of the great work, of the great art. And it means getting hold of a process, of a modus operandi, which exists potentially in the world, but which is not effectively operative there until we somehow make it operative. The world as it is does not operate on the basis of transformation. And when I say world, you know, in Hebrew, olam, in Greek, cosmos, I, of course, also mean the microcosm of the individual and of the individual psyche. This reality, this kind of prefabricated reality within which we live and into which we are born, does not operate on the basis of transformation. It operates far more on the basis of growth. Growth and transformation are not the same thing. Growth involves a unidirectional extension. You got a little plant, tomato plant or something of that sort. This is a good time of the year to grow those things. You know, I already got a few of them ripening. And you will see that the tomato plant, which is really a vine, will, just grows and grows and grows upward, unidirectionally. The potential of the whole tomato vine is present right down there at the root level and even at the seed level before. As it is said, the greatest oak tree is present germinally in the acorn out of which the tree then grows, and it just grows and unfolds. But the alchemist would say that this principle of growth, which is of course also inherent in our bodies and so forth, merely brings an extension of something that is there already. So what happens with growth is more of the same thing, which sometimes is a good thing. If you are growing tomatoes, you'd rather have more than less. or whatever it is, more of the same. But if, on the other hand, your orientation is toward something really new, something that isn't here yet, or something that you haven't experienced yet, then the process of growth will not be able to deliver that kind of a result to you. Okay? And if you extend that sort of on a historical or anthropological level, plane, then you might say that the whole principle that we have become so fascinated by since the, well, I guess it came upon us sort of in the late 18th century, but certainly 19th and 20th century, the idea of evolution also falls within this more limited system. And that is something that perhaps we didn't recognize, that even evolution will not deliver anything really qualitatively different and something radically new. It merely extends a potential that is already present. We are not going to evolve into something that in some fashion we are not already. Neither has any other creature evolved into anything that they were not already in some way or in some sense. They did not change radically. But then there are a few little things, few little events that come up even in biology, and this is the metaphor that is so often used for alchemy. For instance, there are some little incidents that look more like transformation. One of these is, believe it or not, in that weirdest of all forms of life, in the insect kingdom. There is nothing so weird in this world as insects, believe you me. First of all, there are larger number of species and subspecies of insects than of any other kind of creature. And they are weird beyond all belief. They are weird the way they look. They are weird in the things they do. They are weird in the things they don't do. They are really, really weird. So one of the weird things, is the way certain insects spin their larval state, spins itself into a cocoon. And then out of the cocoon comes what is for all intents and purposes a very different kind of insect. Say the silkworm, because from the cocoon of the silkworm we derive all the natural silk products, which are still the best. I remember we used to cultivate silkworms in my native country during the war. And it's very, very strange. The little wormy-looking little thing then spins itself into a cocoon, and then eventually out of the cocoon there emerges a moth-like, butterfly-like creature, which then again lays its eggs, and there goes the life cycle. Now, the biologists tell us that what goes on in that cocoon is very, very strange. It's not that the silkworm gets into some nice, dark, little womb-like enclosure and then begins to change there and grows wings and grows little feet and so forth, but rather the entire previous creature disappears. It is reduced to a kind of black goo, an amorphous organic substance. And then this amorphous organic substance reorganizes, reconstitutes itself, and comes out eventually from the cocoon as an entirely different creature. Now, this is transformation as against growth. And this is the kind of thing that the alchemists were cultivating. And the implications, therefore, of this alchemical principle of transformation, I think, are very, very great. Because when we begin to apply this alchemical principle to various aspects of life, the most important thing that arises out of that consideration is that apparently there is a possibility of change, a kind of change, the result of which will be something entirely different, wholly other than what is now. Now, I know this is somewhat conjectural, but I would suggest that somewhere deeply inside of us, everybody, there is a striving, a desire, a longing for just that, for something that is entirely, wholly, totally different from what is now. And that deeply within us, that is what we are really looking for. That is what we are seeking. And the alchemist, I suggest, sort of indicated for us the process whereby this holy order might come to pass, to use the old-fashioned word. Now, if we are to observe now the alchemical transformation, the various stages of it and what is involved, we also need to keep in mind that we are operating within an ancient framework. Until about the late 18th century, late 18th century, this view of the physical world was considered scientifically correct. Then it changed. And the world view is as follows. The world, the physical world, consists of four elements. That's Western alchemy. In India, would be five. In China, it would be five. Different names and so forth. Actually, the in India would be the same, only a fifth one is added, the Akasha, which is sort of the original matrix. But the four are earth, water, fire, and air, which, as we will see in subsequent discussions, like maybe next time, has been, if not exactly equated, but it has become known as far as the internal nature of the human being is concerned, these four, earth, water, fire, and air, may very well correspond to the four functions of the psychological ego, as indicated by Jung, namely sensation, feeling, thinking, and intuition. It's this tetramorph, as it is called, fourfold figure that kind of constitutes, for instance, our egoic consciousness. So the ancients said everything is composed of earth, water, fire, and air. And now, what happens? Well, what under ordinary circumstances, these four elements merely combine and recombine in various ways and add up to different things, different chemical and compositions and so forth. But if the alchemists get hold of the four elements, which were also sometimes called the four forces, then the alchemist begins to alter this. He alters it in order to bring about a creative or transformative situation. Because nature, natura, as an alchemist would call it, nature on its own does not transform. It's for this reason that the alchemists have said something that maybe a lot of the kind of very nature-worshipping contemporary mind doesn't like. Nature unaided fails. They didn't mean that you have to in order for a flower to grow, you have to go there and grab it and pull it out of the ground, aid it to grow. If you pull it hard enough, you are going to break it or pull it out of the roots. You're going to hurt it. So you can try to aid nature and hurt it at the same time. Yes, but that is not the alchemical way. In the alchemical way, the existing nature of things, indeed of reality, is altered in such a way that a new creation may take place. The implications of this are vast, and I certainly can't go into it tonight, but let me just allude to it, for instance, that in the creative arts, for instance, in literature and poetry and so forth, there are theories which are very much, in certain ways, very much related to the alchemical principle, where the statement is made, for instance, that what the artist does is bring about a new creation. That the artist is the kind of person who is not satisfied with the first creation within which he finds himself, but the artist wants to create something new. And that becomes the secondary creation. It is something really new and something different. So in the creative process of the artist, we also see the alchemical principle represented. However, let's go on and see how the alchemists look at this situation. So there are the four forces, earth, water, fire, and air, or four elements, which make up the outward reality. They make up the world by way of their many and various permutations. Now, the alchemist brings certain, in physical alchemy, brings certain chemical changes about along with the steady application of heat, to the steady, slow, steady flame of the alchemist. The alchemical changes, the physical alchemy, occur in a vessel, the alchemical retort, and various chemicals are being introduced first to break down the existing structure of matter. So a radical altering takes place. The first thing that has to happen, says the alchemist, that the usual structure of matter, and by implication the usual reality, must be broken down, must be radically altered. And in order to do that, now the existing structure is broken down. And now the first phase of alchemy appears. There are four original stages or phases of the alchemical transformation, which often in later alchemy were sort of concentrated or reduced to three. The four are the black, the white, the yellow, and the red. So the first phase after the change, the breaking down has occurred, is the black phase, sometimes in Latin called massa confusa, the confused mass, and which really means that the existing structure of reality has been broken down and made into a creative chaos now. Now, some of you maybe have heard something in recent years about the somewhat abstract and rather incomprehensible statements of chaos theory, which is kind of a more recent scientific and philosophical fashion. But let's say the alchemists had their own chaos theory, which was that a creative chaos must be induced, and then out of this creative chaos will rise the agents of the new creation. These agents of the new creation are, first of all, a duality. Out of the creative chaos in the dark phase of alchemy come two principles. The names given to them are many. Sun and moon, king and queen, or chemically salt and sulfur. The moon is considered feminine, the sun is considered masculine. The sulfur is considered masculine, the salt is considered feminine. And king and queen do not need to be explained in this fashion, and others. These are the creative polarity, which now begins to move, and the two polar forces begin to interact with each other in a prolonged and difficult process of activity, which eventually leads to their abiding union, and by way of their union, something entirely new comes about. But there is yet something very important to consider, because at this point, once the polarities arise, a third factor also appears, a triangulation. And the third factor is a mysterious one, which is referred to as the medium of the conjunction, and its chemical material representative is Mercury, or the spirit of Mercury. So out of the four forces, when the four forces, earth, water, fire, and air, the four elements are reduced, then comes the alchemical trinity, you might say, of salt, sulfur, and mercury. Now, why mercury? Mercury, if you have ever looked at the chemical mercury, is a very peculiar chemical. It's a very peculiar substance. I must have been some kind of alchemist in some remote embodiment, because as a small boy, I had a great proclivity, after I first discovered that this could be done, of breaking thermometers and things of that sort and getting the mercury out and playing with it, which is, of course, quite dangerous because it's poisonous, as all heck get out. But I was bright enough never to eat it. Through the pores, you don't absorb all that much, especially when you move it around with sticks and things of that sort. And of course, what's so exciting, I think, certainly to a child's mind about mercury, is that it seems to be a perfect combination of a liquid and a solid. It runs like a liquid, you know, but then when you hit it and move it around a little bit, it divides into little round globules, which look quite little globes, little balls that are quite solid. I mean, water doesn't form a ball. So it's neither a solid nor a liquid. It's a weird combination of both. And so mercury appeared, I think, to the ancient peoples as being particularly suited to the grand symbol of the conjunction of the opposites, liquid and solid. And of course it has many other properties too. As we will see in alchemical medicine, mercury was also developed then for medical purposes, and in fact the great Paracelsus, the alchemical physician par excellence in the 16th century, had devised a treatment for what was the most terrifying and destructive disease for several centuries, beginning more or less at that time, very much like AIDS is nowadays, and that was syphilis. And the mercury treatment for syphilis was the only treatment that worked from the 16th century until the 20th. In the middle of the 20th century, around World War I, they began to discover other things. First, salvarsan, and later on the antibiotics, penicillin and so forth, and that worked then. So mercury is, one cannot put mercury down. But once again, to try to look at the principle, what we have here now is the present reality, the world as it is now, is broken up and dissolved into a creative chaos, a dark mass. Where does this happen? Physically, it happens in the alchemical retort, and the alchemist is right there looking at it. Then eventually, out of this dark mass, there begin to coalesce the two, the creative opposites that begin to interact with each other, and the mercury is added to them because the mercury is that which aids the conjunction. Mercury comes from outside. Important principle. I think, frankly, if you don't mind me sort of jumping around among metaphors, and if you mind it, I'll still do it, that we have rather forgotten in the contemporary and in the modern world about the kind of principle that is signified by Mercury. Because we think that with the available resources within us or within the world are sufficient. The ancients said no, something has got to come in. That is where Mercury is called the spirit of Mercury. And the spirit is not here. It comes from somewhere. That's why it's called the Holy Spirit. So in order to accomplish this great transformation, something has to come in out of left field. Not from our available resources, not from the material world, not from the world of the personality, but from outside. Now I know we don't like this. We think that there is nothing outside. The alchemists had no problem with it because they were very devout people. They were religious people. They did a tremendous amount of praying and tremendous amount of fasting and all sorts of religious and spiritual exercises before and while engaged in their alchemical work. But whatever we want to call it, we don't have to necessarily adopt a theological framework, but in order for the great change to occur, there has to be help. We can't pull ourselves up entirely by way of our own bootstraps. You know the famous painting of Michelangelo on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, where the finger of Adam and the finger of God touch. Something of the other, has to enter into this for this to really change. And that is a humbling recognition. But without that recognition, and indeed without acting upon that recognition, nothing happens. All right, so now we have the three principles there, the masculine and feminine, the solar and lunar element, the king and the queen, and the Mercury who is inspiriting them and who is making them interact with each other. Now, a long process of interaction takes place. And it is really that process of interaction that occupies the other three stages or phases of alchemy, the white, the yellow, and the red. In the white, the sun dawns. The light, a light begins to arise. The transformation is taking place. Things light up. You can already, if you have a good imagination, you can already make all kinds of psychological analogies that, let's say, if the black phase is a kind of depression, a creative depression now, not just any kind of depression. The late psychologist, disciple of Jung, Dr. Esther Harding, great and wonderful lady, wrote a wonderful little treatise about that, about the wasteland, the creative use of depression. If the black is a kind of depression, when the light begins to dawn in the darkness, that is when the white phase occurs. And then it heats up. The retort heats up more and more. The yellow is a kind of transitional phase from the white to the red, and finally the whole thing becomes red hot, and it's in that red hot, the final phase of the transformation, that the new being, which sometimes is referred to as the stone of the philosophers, sometimes referred to as the elixir of life, and by various other names, then comes out, and this is the ultimate result of the alchemical process. It is something entirely new has come about. There is another, an alchemical treatise that describes it also rather well. And it says, if I recall correctly, at least one version, from a circle make a square. From a square make a triangle. And then from the triangle, make a circle again. So when we can represent this diagrammatically, we work from the outside in. That original circle would be the original creation. We all come out of a circle. from the great serpent biting its own tail, the Ouroboros, as it is sometimes called, a sort of original energy system. Everything comes out of a creative chaos, the nebulae out of which the worlds, at least according to some theories, were supposed to come out. Where the Big Bang fits in is another question. I won't go into that. And then there comes the square, which the square is earth, water, fire, and air, the usual structure of the world. But then the square is reduced eventually to the triangle, to the king and the queen and the spirit of Mercury. And when it is all finished, it is a circle again. But this circle now is the final circle, the philosopher's stone, which is envisioned as round, which is a sphere. And it is, if we interpret it psychologically, it is now the creative, magical, mystical consciousness which is fully aware and fully conscious, while in the beginning it was totally unconscious. So that from unconsciousness, through various stages of transformation, we have arrived at a greater kind of consciousness. Now then, to get a little more detail on this process, what I am describing now are the 10 images of a particular alchemical codex, which in Latin is called the Rosarium Philosophorum, the Rosary of the Philosophers. And it's easy to tell why it's called Rosary, because like the Rosary, it has 10 divisions, which in a decan of the Rosary, and which shows the transformation in the interaction of the two opposites. The first picture is called the Mercurial Fountain, and there is no person there yet, but the fountain is flowing. Within the black phase, now the Mercury has come, and the creative force begins to flow. The dryness of life, the aridity, the wasteland, now begins to be filled with a creative force. And then the two appear, the king and the queen, stand and face each other. That's the second picture. We see them there, and they're fully robed, they have crowns on, their long robes, and so forth. The two have appeared. Then the third picture shows the two, the king and the queen, naked. They always wear their crowns. The king always wears his crown. Don't give that up, you know. But they've taken their clothes off. And they are facing each other now in an undisguised fashion. And the fourth picture shows them immersing themselves in the bath, which is the same as the mercurial fountain. After becoming acquainted, now they are entering the process. And in the bath, they begin to embrace, they begin to come together. The conjunction does take place. They begin to fuse into one, but this is still all within the black phase at this point. You would think that you would have come out of it, but not. And now something strange happens, which shows that the transformation process has its own kind of scary and dark elements, because the new being is beginning to form. The two have merged together and become sort of like an embryo. This new being dies. Lies dead in the water. And that's about where the black phase ends. The transformation has begun, but it has come to a crucial, to a death-like state. Now we see a soul, a little soul, come out and fly upwards from the water wherein the body lies. Rain falls from above. That's the next picture. The waters from above begin to wash the body, and then the soul returns into the body. And after it returns, it all comes back to life again, and the divine androgyne, the living philosopher's stone, the great empress, as the alchemists call it, is born and stands for all to see. So about the first six pictures, including the death, are the black phase. The ones that come afterwards, the ascent of the soul, the rain falling on the corpse, and the return of the souls, are the white phase, and then the tenth one is the red. The yellow and the red have been merged here already into one. In the blackness, which is also often referred to as the killing, the bleeding, the destroying, the torturing of matter. And the alchemical books are all very graphic. They are full of pictures. And they are extremely, how should I put it, stimulating to consciousness. At one time we had a wonderful collection of them in this building, which is now all at the Getty Museum. And one of the most marvelous of them is a scroll, which is called the Ripley Scroll. There are only, I think, about six of them in the world, and which is on a scroll, I believe, of parchment, very, very long. We used to roll it out on about two or three library tables down below. And it shows the alchemical transformation from its beginning to the end. You can sort of walk along the scroll and see it. And, you know, the colorful symbolic figures of dragons and serpents and the sun and moon and fires and toads and frogs and all manner of things that indicate all the various phases of transformation are really a marvel to behold. When you look through that, if your consciousness hasn't changed somewhat, then I would say there is just very little hope for you. At all. That is in the blackness. In the whiteness we have the washing or the purification that leads to the actual whitening. And it is in the white phase, toward the end of the white phase, that a kind of a sub-phase often occurs that the alchemists call the cauda pavonis, the tail of the peacock. When now the white begins to divide and it begins to shimmer in all the colors of the rainbow and opens up like the tail of the peacock in so many colors. And then from there, of course, it moves into the red phase where the final result comes about. Now, I would be very much remiss if I didn't say that before I went on for a little overview for a few minutes of Chinese alchemy, that what about this business of making gold? You know, perhaps some of you are here because you could use a little gold. Every day I hear on the radio that you should buy gold in this stage of the economy and so on and so forth. But I think it's put there by a company who sells gold. So don't necessarily believe it. The objective of alchemy proper was never to make gold. That's nonsense. The way the alchemical mythos goes is that once you have produced the philosopher's stone, the philosopher's stone has the capacity to change base metals into gold. So that when you have the philosopher's stone, which is the product of the alchemical process, you can touch the philosopher's stone to a big lump of lead, and it'll change into gold. Because the philosopher's stone is a magical object that will do that. Now once again, just, you know, use your imagination a little as to what this sort of thing may mean at the psycho-spiritual level. When you have become the living philosopher's stone, which is what one of the alchemical codices says to the alchemist, let you become a living philosopher's stone. When you have become a philosopher's stone, when you have discovered the philosopher's stone, shall we say, within you and in life, then by way of this discovery, you can ennoble, you can orify, make golden anything and everything that you wish. So everything that has looked lowly and heavy and unpleasant before, you touch it with this transformed nature and it becomes precious and becomes gold. The philosopher's stone will even change refuse that is garbage by our words, into all kinds of good things. Which means that when that kind of transformation has taken place, nothing in life is any longer garbage. Everything becomes valuable. Everything becomes something useful and something good. What a tremendous difference from the way life is ordinarily. So there are all these indications, these hints, let's say, of what may happen when the real transformation takes place. Now, about alchemy in the Chinese context. The Indian alchemy is not that much different from ours. So the only one about Indian alchemy I tell you is the little story that the alchemist goes around in the villages in India and, you know, teaches people things. And so the people sit there and he shows them how to put this and that together and how to heat it up and so forth. And says, you know, you do this and then you are going to have wonderful magical things and you'll have gold and so forth. And as he packs up, after they paid him, of course, he says, oh, I forgot one thing. It's very important that when you do this, you never think about monkeys. And he leaves. And of course what happens is that by wishing not to think about monkeys, everybody thinks about monkeys and therefore they never complete the alchemical opus. And of course the alchemist got paid already, so he took off. So keep that in mind. This is what Alan Watts of blessed memory used to call the law of reversed effort. Sometimes, you know, the harder you try not to think of monkeys, the more you think of monkeys. All right. Now, the Chinese alchemy, for the most part, the original concept as it arises in Taoism, which, you know, is the oldest and sort of the most mystical philosophy of old China, instead of using the alchemical retort and the various chemical elements, you know, put into them, placed into them as we would in the West, the alchemical retort becomes the human body. And the objective, ostensible objective, again, one can look at these things symbolically, and then if you want to be very literal-minded, then you can look at them literally, but the literal approach is not all that profitable, I feel. But the objective of Taoist alchemy is immortality. Immortality. Now, the Philosopher's Stone is also supposed to bring immortality, although they don't talk about it all that much in Western alchemy, but it's there. And you know that the Taoist worldview has a great deal to do with the two great principles of the yin and the yang. So right there you have these sort of creative opposites that are somewhat similar to the opposites of Western alchemy. And so what happens is that at birth, the yin and yang principles come together, they combine in a temporary union in the human. And then when you die, they divide again. That's what death is. The yin and yang go their own way. And the masculine, the yang, goes up to heaven. And the feminine, the earthly, goes into the earth. So they divide and they are dead. So the objective is to somehow not allow this to happen so that they are not going to divide. So the Taoist alchemist makes within himself, and the area which is the equivalent of the alchemical retort in the Chinese alchemy is the abdomen. The abdomen is the creative place, not the heart, not the head, but the abdomen. That's why the Chinese start restaurants wherever they go. You know? It's alchemy. Cooking and alchemy have a great deal together. I firmly believe with Carl Jung that no one who doesn't enjoy cooking and good food will ever make a good alchemist. Because, you know, the whole thing is connected, you know, the fire, the brewing, the cooking, the stirring and so forth. It's a symbol. The alchemist's laboratory often even is called the alchemist's kitchen. So in the abdomen by way of certain meditative exercises combined with breathing exercises. So it's very much like a kind of yoga, in fact a kind of Chinese Kundalini yoga. And with the heat of the body, again in the Taoist symbolism, it's assumed that there is a sort of the fire that is burning in the abdomen, in the stomach. And that's how digestion takes place by way of this heat. It's not entirely incorrect, I think, even from a physiological basis. But there now the alchemist creates a new being. It's sometimes called the golden flower. Sometimes it's represented as a little golden man, like a little Buddha sitting there. And this becomes the vehicle of the spirit, of the higher life. A spiritual body within the body. So that when the death of the body takes place, the essence, the essential consciousness of the human will not divide into yin and yang, but now will go into this newly alchemically created being and will become an immortal. See, the Chinese, rather like the ancient Egyptians, had a rather interesting idea. They didn't think that every kind of slob is immortal or is worthy of immortality. Where we developed this funny notion, I don't know, but we just automatically assumed that no matter how stupid we are, no matter how unconscious, no matter how wrong-headed and evil and nasty and wretched, that we are going to be immortal, you know? The great immortal fool, we are going to go on. But the Chinese and the ancient Egyptians, for instance, and various other ancient people said, immortality is something that is earned. If you don't work at it, you're not going to be immortal. And in fact, the Chinese have these, the nine immortals, who, the great sages of China who have become immortal, and Lao Tzu is one of them, and Confucius is another one, and others, and they all sit in a boat, and the wonderful old fellows, they have long wispy beards and all of that. And the thing of what is so wonderful about them is something that Alan Watts used to comment on, that here they are in this boat, but they are each totally individually preoccupied sort of with their own thing. One of them is fishing, and the other one is playing some kind of a game. The other one is doing something else. So you can see that their immortality is a very individual thing. So it's that kind of earned immortality which perhaps we might interpret as consciousness passing to a stage of transformation where it is no longer affected by time. See, it's one idea of immortality is that you go on and on and on in time. I'm not terribly fond of that. I'm kind of tired of going on in time already. Of course, I'm getting old, too. But why, again, to use the alchemist's view, is to just go on and on is just more of the same. But there is a possibility of something else. And that is that consciousness moves into the timeless realm, where it not only endures forever, but it is out of the cycle of duration entirely. The Buddhists would say it's gotten off the great wheel of time. It's no longer held by Mahakala, the great demon who holds the wheel of time. Stopped the world and got off. And that is, let's say, a radically altered consciousness, which really, when you strip the symbolism away from it, is very similar ultimately from the objective of Western alchemy. So we have an interesting convergence here of a quite different imagery from China and from the West. But with a seemingly very similar, indeed, a common objective. A radical and ultimate transformation of what? Well, certainly not just of some material substances that have been put into a retort. That cannot be much more than a symbol, although a symbol is very important. And I'll conclude on this note because that will lead into the discussion of how Jung looked at alchemy, that as the elements transform, there is something does take place in physical alchemy. I mean, it's not a fantasy. These things do change. I have photographs, I've never been present at physical alchemy myself, of the physical alchemical process, and you can really see that whole little vessel, once it's yellow and once it's sort of white, and other times it's sort of red, and so forth. There is a transformative change going on. But what apparently went on, at least in many instances, was that this process became a kind of visually and physically induced meditation for the alchemist. And that as the elements in the retort changed and transformed, so things changed and were transformed within the alchemist. And when the work really managed to get to the point of its ultimate objective, an ultimate objective arose within the alchemist himself. Now, this is not to say that all kinds of physical products and byproducts did not occur. Modern chemistry has profited immensely by way of all kinds of things that came out of the laboratories of the alchemists. Books have been written about it. But they are sort of like the spin-offs, you know, the byproducts. Like there have been all kinds of, I understand, I'm not that well informed about those things, but in computer technology and things of that sort, much of that was a direct spin-off of spaceflight technology. They developed these things for the sake of the space flights, and then now we got all the products here. So there are many, many things came out of alchemy. But those were not the essence of alchemy. It would be a great mistake to think so. The essence of the alchemy seems to have been a significant interior transformation within the alchemists themselves. And in terms of the alchemist's reality, when your reality changes and you change, then everything has changed. When you are transformed, everything around you is transformed. And so what we apparently are dealing with here, to a major extent, is a symbolic system of the transformation of consciousness, of the moving of consciousness to a level of its own potential, which is radically, radically different from anything that it has experienced before. Now, in our own times, in the latter part of the 20th century, I think some intimations of this sort of thing, but it's only one kind of intimation, have come about by way of the psychedelic research. I think people have found out that LSD and some of these substances, sometimes, when people are properly prepared for them, are kind of like little miniature philosopher's stones. Maybe that's where people got so stoned. But it has even been suggested by some fairly serious people that the alchemists themselves may have employed chemicals that had fumes, which were consciousness-altering, and that some chemical consciousness-altering may have also been involved in alchemy. We don't really know. If so, it was probably still not its essence. It just may have been a particular aspect or an occasional aspect. But it's a great and mysterious and wondrous subject because I think it holds open for us the possibility of radical transformation of consciousness, the ability of consciousness to move into a realm that is outside of the limitations of time, outside of the limitations of space, indeed outside of all of the limitations within which we ordinarily find ourselves when we are in that square box of earth, water, fire, and air, which constitutes our present reality, that there is an other reality. But in order to get to that other reality, something has to be done. It will not, as the Christian scripture says about some great events, it will not come by expectation. You can sit and expect and hope until all the sacred cows come home and nothing else will happen. It will not come by faith. It will not come by just believing in it. And I'm sorry to say, as a lecturer, that kind of knocks my status down, that it doesn't really come by talking about it either. But as the alchemist said, it must be an opus. It must be a work. That there is a work before us. And then eventually it produces a wonderful thing, a real wholeness. That is the philosopher's stone. So God bless you, and we'll see you next week if all goes well. Thanks so much.
Copyright MNI by BC Recordings. Catalog number 300101. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.